It's the takeaway for Wednesday, January 10th, 2018.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. It's great to have you with us today. And we've got a lot coming up this hour. A powerful Republican congressman explains why Congress has failed to reauthorize safety net health insurance for 9 million low-income children. And then at the end of the hour, what's behind new research showing that children in the United States have a worse chance of making it to adulthood than kids in other developed countries? But first, in Washington, on Capitol Hill, a bombshell in the Russia investigation. On Tuesday, California Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein posted on her website Judiciary Committee testimony from a key figure in the now famous dossier compiled by a British spy on then-candidate Donald Trump. Glenn Simpson is the founder of Fusion GPS. That's a company that was hired by Hillary Clinton's campaign, and before that by a conservative online newspaper, to investigate possible connections between Donald Trump and Russians and the Kremlin. Fusion hired former British spy and Russia expert Christopher Steele to do that job, and the dossier became a sensational trove of allegations of collusion and money laundering and salacious details. It's also at the center of partisan warfare over the Russia investigation, both inside and outside the FBI. So Dianne Feinstein aired out Glenn Simpson's August closed-door testimony in front of the Judiciary Committee. That enraged Republicans, but Feinstein says it's the only way to set the record straight in a fog of misinformation about that dossier and what the FBI knew when it started investigating Donald Trump. Byron Tao is a congressional reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, Byron.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. Byron, remind us of just a couple of these key characters that I mentioned. Glenn Simpson testified in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's the transcript that everyone's reading now. And Christopher Steele is a Russia expert, former UK spy. Who are Simpson and Steele?
So Glenn Simpson is a former Wall Street Journal reporter. He left the Journal about 10 years ago, went into the private opposition research business, joined up with a couple other journalists, formed this firm called Fusion, and has been doing opposition research for mostly business clients, but occasionally a political client here and there, for about 10 years. Chris Steele is a former MI6 British spy who has worked on the Russia desk in the UK and has deep experience in the Soviet Union and post-Soviet Russia, and was hired as a subcontractor as part of Fusion GPS's research into Donald Trump.
And Christopher Steele put together lots and lots of memos that became what's now known as the dossier. President Trump was briefed on the dossier. So was President Obama during the transition by then FBI Director James Comey. So Glenn Simpson testifies to the Judiciary Committee. That's the transcript that we're all reading now and we're all reading yesterday. His firm and that dossier have been the source of lots of partisan warfare, Byron. But what did Glenn Simpson have to say that sheds substantive light on the Russia investigation now?
Well, Glenn Simpson essentially fleshed out how his firm came to be involved in doing this research on Donald Trump. He said he was approached in early 2015 by a conservative donor or publication. He refuses to say in the testimony, though we later learn it's the Washington Free Beacon, which is backed by a fairly prominent conservative donor named Paul Singer. But essentially, he started doing the standard operating procedure for opposition research, which is to essentially read all of this candidate's material. So he read all of Donald Trump's books. He started doing research into his business records and eventually hits a brick wall at some point, says he needs to go deeper into these Russia connections and these business ties abroad, ends up hiring this British spy who starts writing memos in the summer of 2016 that form the basis of this 35-page dossier that's at the center of so much controversy.
Well, part of what we learned seems to be that the FBI considered the dossier credible, at least in part, especially because it was corroborating some information that the FBI already had from other sources, at least according to what Glenn Simpson has told senators.
That's right. So Christopher Steele apparently became so alarmed by what he was learning in the course of this research that he twice sat down with the FBI, once in the summer of 2016 and once later in the fall. The dossier was given to FBI officials and also it was given to political figures in Washington. It ended up in the hands of John McCain at one point. And you know, he walked them through his research, and it was essentially a meeting that he sought out with the FBI to share what he learned.
Well, Simpson also says, Byron, that Christopher Steele, at one point in his interactions with the FBI, became alarmed that candidate Trump was compromised by Russians or open to blackmail. So alarmed, in fact, that in Simpson's words, Christopher Steele sort of called 911, went to the FBI with that information, said he was concerned that there was a crime in progress. That might be hyperbolic. It might not. What do we know about that statement, that there might be a crime in progress?
Well, that's an interesting question. We don't know a ton. I mean, we do have the dossier. It was published by BuzzFeed early last year, so I think January, February of 2017. And FBI law enforcement intelligence agencies and the media all had a look at it. But essentially, Steele is saying that the things he learned were so disturbing, the things he thought were true alarmed him so much that he feared that Donald Trump, who was a nominee for the Republican Party in the presidential election, was susceptible to some sort of blackmail or susceptible to other forms of influence. And that's why he decided to approach law enforcement himself.
Meanwhile, back on Capitol Hill, it was pretty shocking that Dianne Feinstein released Glenn Simpson's testimony here. This was over the objections of her Republican colleagues on that Judiciary Committee. Why did Dianne Feinstein do this?
That's right. Essentially, when you have an investigation on Capitol Hill, typically the parties try to accommodate each other. And the wishes of the chairman in this case, who was Chuck Grassley, was that the testimony would be kept private until the investigation was finished. And then they would hope to release a lot of this stuff that they've gathered. But Dianne Feinstein said that the number of rumors and innuendo that had circulated about Christopher Steele and Glenn Simpson and Fusion GPS and this infamous dossier warranted extra transparency, and that she wanted to tell the story of how this dossier came about and put out the transcript yesterday over the objections of her Republican counterpart on the committee.
Well, Feinstein says she wants more transparency. She went around Chuck Grassley. But then the corollary question, Byron, is given what we see now in Simpson's testimony, why didn't Republicans want this testimony public? Why didn't they want anyone to know about it?
Well, Republicans say that when you conduct an investigation, you want to compare witness statements to each other without them being able to see what they testify. So this is a common law enforcement tactic. If you bring in one witness and a second witness, you don't want them to communicate with each other. You don't want them to know what they're saying. So they say the integrity of the investigation is compromised when you release transcripts too early, or when witnesses can compare notes or see what each other testified. And so that was their concern with releasing this testimony yesterday.
Well, Byron, before we let you go, you know, I think there's one question at the bottom line of this. The president and a lot of his allies have attacked that Steele memo as fake news, Fusion GPS as fake, or a partisan outfit doing the bidding of Democrats and Hillary Clinton. Based on what we know now, is the dossier fake? Is the president right?
Well, so that's sort of the $100 million question. Glenn Simpson said in this testimony that was released yesterday that it's wrong to call it phony, that these were real interviews that a real British spy conducted, and that these charges or these allegations warrant much further investigation. So that's essentially what we know now. But the question is, at the heart of it, is it true? And that's something we can't say.
Byron Tao on Capitol Hill for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Byron.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's stay in Washington now, because as Congress scrambles to find a fix for DACA, a federal judge in San Francisco has weighed in now. Judge William Aslip issued a nationwide injunction against the Trump administration's plan to roll back protections for 800,000 young people who came to the country illegally when they were children. The decision sows a new wrinkle into the fight in Congress over DACA and whether a fix will include money for the president's border wall. For more, Leon Fresco, immigration attorney and former deputy assistant attorney general at the Justice Department. Leon, great to have you back.
Great to be here.
So the president's decision to end the DACA program in March is what set Congress on this course of trying to find an immigration deal. Now the federal judge in San Francisco says, President Trump, you can't end the program this way. Why not?
Well, so what the court ruled was that if an agency is going to take an action, that action has to be in conformance with the law. And so what the court did is it took a very narrow focus on the specific reason in the text that was given for ending the DACA program, which is that in the text it said the DACA program is illegal. And the court took issue with that and said the DACA program is not illegal because there have been numerous instances of programmatic issuances of deferred action, meaning that groups in the past on a handful of occasions have been given deferred action, have had their deportation delayed. And so they could not say that it was illegal to have a program like DACA. And because that is a flawed legal conclusion in the court's mind, the agency couldn't take the action based on that flawed legal conclusion. They would have had to issue guidance which said, we think DACA is a bad policy, and so we're discontinuing it because we think it's a bad policy. But because that wasn't in the document, then the court said, if the only reason you're rescinding it is because it's illegal, well, that is flawed because it's not illegal. Hmm.
Well, it's a nationwide injunction for now, Leon. What does this mean for DACA recipients? Is it a true reprieve?
Well, here's what's interesting about this. If the Ninth Circuit follows the same tact as the Fifth Circuit did in 2014 when the DAPA program was enjoined, the Ninth Circuit could decide to hold an appeal for quite a long time so that the Supreme Court's term, which ends in June, they don't get to hear this case in this term, such that this could potentially be an injunction that takes the DACA program all the way into potentially May of 2019 with people being able to have DACA status. Now, whether people will want to come forward and reapply for DACA status is an interesting question, although the Trump administration already has their information. So it doesn't seem like there would be a significant risk in reapplying. But it is potentially, depending on how much the Ninth Circuit wants to slow walk a decision on appeal, this could be a potentially lengthy injunction.
Well, Leon, if I know anything about Congress, it's that lawmakers love any excuse for delay and not to make some tough decisions. Is that what this is going to wind up being, an excuse to not make a DACA deal, even though the president and members of Congress were talking about it so publicly yesterday?
I mean, potentially it could be. What I think might happen is that the government funding will carry from funding bill to funding bill, something that says you can't deport DACA kids without any sort of larger trade. And it will keep sort of punting the issue until they can come up with a larger trade, which may or may not happen.
A federal judge in San Francisco throws a big wrinkle into the debate in Washington over DACA recipients, 800,000 of them, and a potential deal of whether keeping them in the country has to be tied to billions of dollars for the president's border wall. This is a decision that could extend months, possibly even years, says Leon Fresco, former Deputy Assistant Attorney General at the Justice Department. Leon, always great to have you.
Thank you. Great to be on the show.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Babbel, a language app that teaches real-life conversations in a new language like Spanish, French, and German. Babbel's 10 to 15-minute lessons are available in the App Store or online at Babbel, BABBEL.com.
And Staples, offering storage solutions for business including file folders, banker's boxes, and storage bins for getting organized. More at Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, it's pro time.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with WGBH Radio in Boston.
It's Todd Zwillick. Welcome back. Thanks for being with us today. Tens of millions of registered voters didn't vote in the last presidential election. Maybe you were one of them. But if you didn't vote for 2 years, one election cycle, or maybe two, should the state be able to turn around and throw out your voter registration altogether and basically make it harder for you to vote the next time? That's the question before justices today, as the Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a case challenging voting rules in Ohio. ML Schultze is a reporter for WKSU in northeastern Ohio. She's here to bring us through the case, which is called Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. Schultze, thanks for being with us.
Hey, Todd. It's good to be here.
Schultze, first, how does it work in Ohio? Tell us about this so-called supplemental process that removes people from voter rolls. How does it work?
Okay. And you'll know by who you're listening to which years get emphasized. The idea is if you don't vote for 2 years, you get a card or a letter. It varies by all 88 counties' Board of Elections. And they say, yoo-hoo, do you still want to vote? Do you still want to be registered to vote? If you don't respond to that and you don't vote again or sign a petition or in some way participate in the electoral process over the next 4 years, you're off the rolls. And if you talk to John Houston, the Secretary of State, that's a lot of time. That's a lot of notice. There shouldn't be an argument here. You don't value your right to vote. If you talk to the people who have filed this lawsuit, they're saying you're not voting is a matter of free speech and that the law, the voting law, says you can't take somebody off the rolls simply because they choose to be, say, maybe one of 95 million people who don't vote.
Well, how many people does this affect in Ohio?
Well, directly last year, there were about 7,500 votes, 7,500 ballots that were initially said, no, these people cannot vote. They voted by provisional ballot, and the court said, no, you do need to count those. So just in that one election, it was about 7,500 people, one of whom is a guy named Larry Harmon, who lives right near us, and he's a vet. He's voted repeatedly over the years, and then for a combination of reasons, family tragedies, things like that. And also just he didn't really like the candidates. He decided what he calls a free speech issue not to vote.
Well, Schulze, what does federal law say about whether you can purge someone simply for not voting? Aren't there rules at the federal level?
There are. And this is where it really gets you really get into splitting some hairs here. It says you cannot remove somebody from the rolls simply because they choose not to vote. What Ohio says is we're not removing them for not voting. We're removing them for not responding to the notice or in some other way engaging us to tell us they still live where we think they live and they still are engaged in the process.
Mm. That sounds like it could be interpreted as a technicality or at least a matter of interpretation. But Schulze, look, there's a broad debate in this country about voter suppression. We know that. We've seen voter ID laws, other laws struck down by courts in states controlled by Republicans, including North Carolina. Do critics charge that this is a voter suppression method in Ohio?
They say, regardless of what the intent is, the effect is yes, because the people who are least likely to see those postcards or to get those letters are people who are homeless and may have an established residence, but are not getting that kind of mail. The other thing that's come up is a lot of folks are pointing out it's as different as the 88 counties. Even though the rule says you are supposed to get rid of people after this process, there's some boards of elections who say, what's it hurt to keep people on? And there are other boards of elections who go through a computer program. Others are meticulous to double check everything. And so as long as it's as varied as that, you have some problems showing up where, for example, Cleveland, Columbus, Cincinnati, disproportionately those people are being purged as opposed to some of the more suburban rural counties.
Hmm. And that might look to many critics like voter suppression when the rules are put into practice. Well, Schulze, what's the actual question before Supreme Court justices today? I said the case is called Husted versus A. Philip Randolph Institute. What's the Supreme Court deciding here?
The Supreme Court is deciding if, in fact, that very fine idea of we are not taking people off for not voting, so therefore we are not violating the federal law, is that whether that holds sway or, as the critics charge, no, in effect, you are pulling people off simply because they say, I don't want to vote in this election or in this series of elections.
And the parties in this case, who are they?
The parties are the Randolph Institute, which represents homeless people to a large extent and others. Even though this process has been in effect under both Republican and Democratic secretaries of state, it has fallen on party lines largely. The Democrats are saying what you're doing is effectively targeting our voters, the people who are going to vote for us. And so they're challenging it. But you do have some interesting people who have aligned with this group. You have, like I said, Larry Harmon, who's a member of the NRA and a vet and may not fall in what people consider a Democratic category. You have other vets, the mayor of Oak Harbor, a small town northwest of here, who are joining in this and saying, I shouldn't lose my right to vote because I exercise my right not to vote.
What has the path for this case looked like so far in the lower courts?
A district judge sided with the state. It then went to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals, and in a 2-1 decision, it said, no, you've got to count those votes. This was in 2016. Now it's to the Supreme Court. You have about 17, 18 states, mostly Republican, who have sided with Ohio. At one point, you had the Obama administration Justice Department siding with the Institute. That under President Trump, the Justice Department changed sides, and now it's arguing that Ohio is doing what it should do.
So, look, Schulte, it's pretty clear. I mean, we're talking about Ohio. You're in Ohio, but the Supreme Court has taken this case with, as you said, dozens of states and two justice departments on opposite sides of this issue, because this isn't really about Ohio, is it? This is going to be about what states can do across the country when it comes to managing who can vote and who can't.
As with anything political, Ohio is often a sign of the times, and what happens here extends way beyond Ohio.
Yeah, the quintessential swing state, not just at election time, but apparently in front of the courts as well. ML Schulte, reporter for WKSU in northeastern Ohio. Schulte, thanks so much for coming on and for walking us through this case. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Todd.
Let's go to Southern California now, and another deadly natural disaster. Mudslides swept away homes in Santa Barbara County, California on Tuesday, leaving at least 15 people dead. Heavy rainfall pummeled the mountains rising from the Pacific coast there, already left barren in many places by wildfires in recent weeks. The result was a deadly river of mud and debris that trapped dozens of people and left roads and bridges impassable. Lance Orozco is news director and field reporter for KCLU in Southern California. He's on the ground there. Lance, welcome.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
I'm well. Lance, tell us what you're seeing right now.
Well, it's almost a surreal kind of atmosphere here. And I can look from my vantage point. I'm in the foothills above Montecito. And there are boulders here the size of a small car, and that's part of what rolled down from the mountains here. One of the firefighters told me that normally when we get rain in these mountains, it's about 6 miles from the mountaintop to the ocean. It would take about a day for the water to get down from the top of the mountains to the ocean. Because of the fact that the slopes have been stripped bare, it only takes about 15 minutes right now, and that's exactly what happened early yesterday. It basically just roared down out of the mountain, came down through some canyons, took out a number of homes, and then went down through Highway 101, which is the main coastal highway between San Francisco and Los Angeles, and closed that highway completely. And in the process, a lot of people lost their lives, and a lot of people are still missing.
What have residents said to you about what the scene was like as this wall of mud slid down past their homes, through their homes in some cases, and down the highway?
Well, frankly, a lot of people are just in shock because you have to remember, we've had the Thomas Fire, which is the largest brush fire in California history, 282,000 acres. And even though we've had the rain, technically it's still not fully contained yet. And so some of these residents had been out of their homes for 2 weeks because of the fire. They'd been in evacuation areas. They came back in and then they were told, okay, you need to evacuate again. Some did and some didn't. And a lot of people just didn't think something like this could happen.
Well, that was the human connection to the wildfires, Lance. But there's also an ecological one, because the wildfire swept away a lot of the trees, and that's directly helped the mud slide down the mountain, hasn't it?
It has. And part of the problem with Montecito, I mean, Montecito is beautiful. It's famous because Oprah Winfrey lives here. It's famous because Ellen DeGeneres lives here. Actors like Jeff Bridges and Kenny Loggins have homes here. But part of the problem is the homes go right up into the hills. So you've got these massive mountains, and then you've got homes right up against it. And so when the mountains were stripped bare, I mean, basically there's no buffer zone. The water was able to just literally come down right off the mountains and start going into homes.
So what does rescue look like now? How many rescue workers are on the scene? I assume many of them have already been in the neighborhood because of the fires.
Well, it's interesting because public safety workers knew this was coming because the National Weather Service was saying this big storm was coming. They actually told us on Friday, they had a news conference, and they said, listen, this storm is going to be big. People need to be prepared, and they need to evacuate. And as a result of that, on Monday, right before the storm hit, they actually had extra firefighters moved into the area because they thought, okay, we may have a situation where we need to rescue people. And so there are more than 500 firefighters here now, and they work through the night, and they're going to continue working because there's still not, they don't consider this recovery. They're still hoping to find some people alive in the debris.
And that's the last question I want to ask you, which is, what are authorities saying about the possibility of more casualties now as they continue to search?
Well, Sheriff Bill Brown is saying that we hope the death toll won't go higher, but we think it will.
Lance Orozco on the ground in Santa Barbara County in California, hit by devastating mudslides. Lance is news director and field reporter for KCLU. Lance, thank you.
Thank you.
Please admit the Honorable Sam Brownback, Governor of the State of Kansas.
Republican Governor Sam Brownback delivered his final State of the State speech in Topeka, Kansas last night. Brownback's term ends early next year, but back in July, President Trump nominated him to be an at-large ambassador. Well, that sounds good. Governor Brownback can get a new job, travel the world promoting religious freedom. The problem is that the very Senate where Sam Brownback used to be a member never confirmed him, and he still hasn't stepped down as governor of Kansas, even though the lieutenant governor has been taking over a lot of the responsibilities. And Brownback says he's not going anywhere until the Senate finally confirms him for his new ambassadorship. And the whole thing is frustrating Kansas lawmakers because of the simple question, who's in charge? Republican State Senator Barbara Beaulieu joins me now. She represents the 7th District in Kansas. Senator, welcome back.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
The State of the State speech from Governor Brownback last night, awkward at all? How was it?
It was unprecedented in that he received almost no applause during his speech. He announced $600 million for our schools, and there was no applause, even though most of us want more funding for schools. But the fact that he stepped in with a, quote, what he calls a solution with actually no solution, no plan for how to pay for that. And he really stepped into a mess of causing great difficulty for us to move forward as we try to actually find a solution for our court case.
Well, it sounds like those of you in the legislature aren't buying what Governor Brownback is selling anymore. Is he in charge? Is Jeff Collier, the lieutenant governor, in charge? Who do you call?
Well, it's like Abbott and Costello, who's on first? And my question, are we playing baseball still? It's very difficult to tell. Lieutenant Governor Collier has been allowed to appoint some of the new secretaries because many of his administration has been leaving, fleeing the ship is what it looks like. And yet, he is staying. He insisted on doing the State of the State last night. He says he won't step down until he's actually has a new job. We can't tell if he will or won't. He can't tell. It's very difficult for all of us.
Well, let's talk about what's going on in Kansas, Senator. You mentioned $600 million for education and no applause from a bunch of skeptical legislators like you. What else is on the docket in Kansas that's getting complicated now? There's gun control legislation. What else?
I would say, quite honestly, the number one and primary focus of the session will be the school funding issue, because it then affects our potentially affects tax structure, and it also really impacts our budget. We do not even remotely have $600 million to add into a budget, and we are constitutionally required to have a balanced budget. So we have quite a bit to talk about and figure out. I'm not really sure what all we'll be working on. Yes, gun control is an issue, but it's never moved forward. If Governor Brownback stays, he will veto everything. We don't know where the lieutenant governor might stand. So all of our things moving forward, we don't know how to move forward when we are not sure who we're going to be having as the possible big V veto ability.
Well, Senator, it sounds like a lot of you are frustrated and frustrated with the governor of your own party. He won't step down. Work's not getting done. If Governor Brownback won't go, has anyone in the legislature talked about removing him?
Not to my knowledge.
And why not?
Well, I don't know that you could remove him without him doing something, quote, that's impeachable. And he has not done that. And I don't think he would ever do that. So at this point, he is our governor and he will stay our governor until he chooses not to be our governor anymore.
And when would you like to see that happen?
If he thinks he's going to leave, the sooner the better, because then we can move forward and get going on what needs to be accomplished. We have a 90-day session. We are now on our, have 87 days left. So the clock is ticking. And with that small amount of time, we need to keep moving and moving responsibly and quickly to get what is needed for our state and our constituencies.
Senator Barbara Beaulieu, Republican of the 7th District in Kansas, thanks again.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for joining us on The Takeaway today. I'm Todd Zwillick, and let's go back to Washington now, where more than 3 months ago, Congress let the Children's Health Insurance Program expire. CHIP provides health care to 9 million low- and middle-income kids, and in some states, to pregnant women, too. Now, pretty much everyone in Congress supports CHIP. Republicans and Democrats have been voting for CHIP since 1997. But now, there's a fight over paying for the relatively tiny program, even in the era of $1.4 trillion unfinanced tax cuts. Congress passed a temporary bill last month that was supposed to keep CHIP going until March 1st. That wasn't enough. And now news that funding could run out as early as next week. So more than 100 days after the CHIP program expired, what's going on? I'm putting that question now to Congressman Greg Walden, a Republican representing the 2nd Congressional District in Eastern Oregon. Congressman Walden is also chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, which has jurisdiction over the CHIP program. Chairman Walden, welcome.
Hey, it's good to be with you. Thank you.
Well, Congressman, the House and Senate passed a short-term funding deal for CHIP last month, dedicating about $2.8 billion to this program. That was supposed to fund children's health insurance until March, but now HHS is warning everybody that funding will only last until January 19th. That's the end of next week. What happened?
We actually knew that at the time. What it was an authorization through April, but we knew, and I think HHS knew, that the funding would never stretch to April. That's why we have acted in the committee, passed a bill that fully funds it, one of the most generous levels in history, sent it over to the Senate with a bipartisan vote. This needed to be done last fall when the authorization for the program expired at the end of September. And so there are a couple things here that we took care of in the House. You got to find, frankly, 9 Democrat senators or however many to put this together and get it to the president. This needs to happen.
Well, you act to authorize it, but getting the money to spend is a separate issue, as you know. And that seems to be where a lot of people can't get on the same page while these kids languish, Congressman. We'll talk about that in just a minute. I want to play for you Erin Miller. She's vice president of health initiatives for the Colorado Children's Campaign. She was on this show a couple of weeks ago talking about the delays in CHIP funding and how it's affecting people in Colorado.
Colorado is one of the minority of states that actually provides coverage not just for kids, but also for pregnant women through this program. And so those pregnant women, I mean, there are pregnant women with due dates in February and March, and they're wondering if their health insurance is going to be there for them when they really need it. And that kind of stress, it's not good for pregnant women. It's not good for young kids. This is just a really tough way to sort of run an insurance program.
Look, you're chairman of an authorizing committee, but Congress still hasn't gotten this done. It's having a real effect on people and their lives.
Well, first of all, let me make 2 points, Todd. One, not only did we authorize it for 5 years, we also identified the funding sources to pay for it for 5 years. So in the House, we did both and sent that to the Senate. Second, I fully concur. People shouldn't be put into this stress, especially pregnant women, worrying about this. But they should also know, and your listeners should know, that Congress has continued the program throughout this period and funded it fully. And so it has not ended. It did not terminate. But that's no way to run an insurance program. We got our job done, funded it fully, the most generous level, sent it to the Senate, and we're waiting for them to put together a plan. We need to get this done.
Yeah, I guess it's the big picture that I don't get, Congressman, after covering Congress myself for so many years. I know that you all will work out funding sources. I get it. Whether it's Nancy Pelosi's fault or Greg Walden's fault or Paul Ryan's fault, isn't as important, it seems to me, as the big question. A lot of Americans looking at Congress again and seeing a $1.4 trillion tax cut added to the deficit, but then a huge fight over how to pay for an $800 million program that's tiny for kids. Shouldn't people be concerned about that?
Yeah. This is one of the frustrations we have.
I mean, it seems like flipped priorities, I guess.
Well, and it's apples and oranges. We do a lot of work on different programs, reauthorizing, and we've got brownfields modernization going, Safe Drinking Water Act legislation moving through that we're trying to identify a funding source for and modernize. Those are coming out. We work on a lot of different programs, and our committee doesn't have, you know, jurisdiction over the tax code. That's Ways and Means Committee. It is Congress. I'm not taking that away. I'm actually confident in these negotiations that are going on now, and with a lower price tag from $8 billion to $800 million. How does that happen? But it's long and convoluted discussion with the Congressional Budget Office. Long and short of it is, we now have an $800 million program. Last week, we thought it was an $8 billion program. And by the way, now they say if we extend it 10 years, we'll actually save $6 billion. Long and short of it is, this has always been a bipartisan program. As long as it's ever been extended, we found paid fors. We got a bipartisan vote, and it's jammed up in the Senate.
I guess
we need Chuck Schumer's help. We need, you know, Ron Wyden's help. And I've talked to Ron. He's my colleague in the Senate on the other side of the aisle from Oregon, the ranking guy on finance. He wants to get this done.
I guess people just don't get why this is so hard for such a small, effective, and cheap program. But Congressman, let me ask you about your district, the second district in eastern Oregon there. 122,000 kids across Oregon with CHIP. Your district had a massive uptake in Medicaid expansion when Oregon took up the Medicaid expansion under Obamacare, but you were a major advocate for pulling back on Medicaid under the ACA. What are your constituents saying to you, not only about Medicaid, but about CHIP as well during this funding fight?
Well, clearly, CHIP is something I've supported throughout the process. Our community health centers I've supported throughout the process. Look, we were trying to find something to give states more flexibility and a budget that could be sustainable. These are very important programs for people in my state and across America, but they are not sustainable if we don't get them right.
So, Congressman Greg Walden, I'm going to let you go. $800 million, like you said, to reauthorize CHIP. It sounds funny, but it's a drop in the bucket. You guys going to get this done? Everyone's for it, I hear.
Yes.
How long?
Hopefully next week.
Congressman Greg Walden is the Republican chairman of the Energy and Commerce Committee in the House. Congressman, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, Todd.
We shift now to a new study, though, out this week that offers a grim assessment of the state of children's health in America.
The U.S. is the most dangerous of wealthy democratic countries for children.
That's Ashish Tucker, their lead author on the study. He's an internal medicine resident at Johns Hopkins Hospital in Baltimore. His research was published in the journal Health Affairs on Monday. Dr. Tucker told me that even as child mortality rates decline worldwide, American kids are simply less likely to make it to adulthood than kids in other industrialized countries.
To start with, I think it's important to highlight that over the last 50 years, children are dying less often. So these are still quite rare events. That said, when you compare the U.S. to these other countries, U.S. children are dying at 70% greater rates than they are in these other wealthy countries.
So 70% more likely to not make it to adulthood, even though overall the trend is a safer trend for kids, at least in industrialized countries. Let's dig into some of those numbers a little bit. The United States has higher infant mortality than other comparable nations. How much higher is it, and why is that?
So infant mortality is substantially higher in the U.S. than in other countries. Infants are dying at 75% greater rates than in other countries. So that means for out of every 10,000 infants that are born, 30 more are dying in the U.S. than in these other similar countries. And what are they dying from? So we see the leading cause of infant mortality in the U.S. over these 50 years has been from prematurity. The second leading cause of death for the last 10 years in this study was sudden infant death syndrome. Now, for both of these causes, U.S. children are dying at 2 and 3 times the rate that they are in these other countries.
Well, premature birth and SIDS, sudden infant death, exist in other countries too. So then the question is, why are we losing more babies here in the United States than other countries are?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that makes it challenging is both prematurity and sudden infant death syndromes are really poorly defined in terms of what causes them medically. We don't understand why certain babies are born premature and why others aren't. But what we have seen is that both prematurity and SIDS track very closely along the social gradient. So you have mothers and families who are poor, who come from less privileged socioeconomic backgrounds, and unfortunately who are more often than not families of color, who are doing much worse in all of these areas. So what we see is that these causes of infant mortality are largely related to the social environment in which these children are born into.
So that's the infants. Let's talk about older kids, because children in your study go all the way to 19 or 20. You get into the adolescents, the 15 to 19-year-olds. How do American kids stack up to their counterparts in other countries?
Yeah, so we're doing really poorly in terms of taking care of our 15 to 19-year-olds compared to other countries. What we saw is that between infants and this 15 to 19-year-old age group accounted for 90% of the excess deaths in the U.S. compared to these other countries. So why are these older teens dying? Well, the main reason we saw was from injuries, actually. So the leading cause of death for these 15 to 19-year-olds came from motor vehicle accidents. The second leading cause of death in the U.S. came from assault by firearm. What we see is that death from gun violence in other countries is basically non-existent. So the statistic we reported in the paper is that children in the U.S. are 82 times more likely to die from gun violence. Now, that number, it's very high. It could have just as easily been 100. It could have just as easily been 150, because the denominator there is basically zero. There are almost no deaths from gun violence in these other wealthy democratic countries.
Well, Ashish, if we take guns out of the equation because they're so much more common here than in other countries, what are other countries doing differently when it comes to infants, when it comes to car accidents, when it comes to prematurity? Is this a function of better medical care, better public health, better insurance coverage? Why are we losing kids at a greater rate than comparable countries?
So this really does not have to do with medical care. What we saw in our paper is that all of the causes of death related to direct medical care, the U.S. is doing just as well as these other countries. So when you look at infectious diseases, we have basically matched the rate of mortality in these other countries. But when you look at the causes of death for children that are tied to social determinants of health, those are the ones in which we do much worse. So it's exactly like you said. I think this has to do with child poverty rates. The U.S. has the highest child poverty rate out of any of these 19 countries, and it has had the highest child poverty rate since the 1980s. We also have worse educational attainment for all our children. So we started making international comparisons of educational attainment in the mid-60s, and from that time onward, the U.S. has performed in the lowest of these 20 countries. And the third thing we have to look at is the fractured social safety net that's available to children everywhere. So right now in this country, in order to qualify for certain of these social programs, such as Medicaid, such as CHIP, you have to meet certain requirements. And what you tend to see is that families move in and out of qualifying for these social services.
Ashish, you know, Americans hear the line all the time that they have the best health care in the world. And I can't tell you how many times I've heard lawmakers on the floor of the House or the Senate say that line. They say it all the time. But you have a lot of data here where American children are much more likely to die before the age of 19 than anywhere else in the world, or at least comparable countries around the world. So that line that America has the best health care in the world, is that true?
It's not. And I think this study should serve as a wake-up call for all of us. We have the most resources out of any country in the world, and we spend the most money per child on healthcare out of any country in the world. But what we're not doing is we're not preventing these same children from getting sick in the first place.
Dr. Ashish Tucker of Johns Hopkins, internal medicine resident, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Well, yesterday, Jessica Bennett, the gender editor of the New York Times, and Koa Beck, editor-in-chief of Jezebel, were here with their weekly discussion about the Me Too movement. Jessica and Koa talked about how workplace harassment can crush ambitions and ruin or reroute careers. So we asked you for your experiences. Can you relate? So many of you said yes.
Tiffany from Carmel, New York. I was sexually harassed by both my immediate managers and the men on the floor when I worked in a factory, to the point where I went back to school so that I didn't have to work in a factory environment, even though that initial job where they were harassing me required a technical degree in chemistry or biology. To this day, I am not comfortable alone in large buildings like that because I'm not sure who is trying to lure me there so that they can do despicable things.
Hi, my name is Jessica from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I was recently pushed out of a job after I filed a complaint about sexual harassment from one of my peers. He was very high up. He's part of the executive team. And after I filed my complaint, there was an investigation and he was let go from the company. And due to hostility, I had to leave my job.
Your stories there of how harassment in the workplace can derail a job or a career. Well, some of you called in to say that today in some industries, there is hope.
Hi, this is Jessie from St. Louis, Missouri. I'm a tattoo artist and tattooing has been a boys' club forever, but the floodgates are finally open and there's plenty of women in the industry that are finally being taken seriously. And all the guys that have taken advantage of the trust that their position holds are finished.
You can always get in touch with us, 8778-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. And again, your voice on this show is one of the most important things that we do. You can find more of our Me Too conversations on our website there at thetakeaway.org/MeTooMemos. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.